Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is the Reverend Renee Rahutsky, and it is my privilege to serve as the affiliated community minister of this congregation. I am joined in welcoming you this morning by Trish McLaughlin, who is our worship associate, and our music director, Hal Walker. Our called minister is the Reverend Melissa Carvel-Zemer.
At times, our own light goes out and is rekindled by a spark from another person. Each of us has cause to think with deep gratitude of those who have lighted the flame within us. Service is one dear to my heart, and I've given it a lot of thought. I'll give you just a little personal background first, if you don't know me. About 40 years ago, I was diagnosed with celiac disease, and ever since then, I've had to obsessively read food labels to discover if they contain wheat or rye or oats or barley or anything with gluten in it. And since that diagnosis, I felt like I was remarkably healthy. And that continued until I was 48 years old, when out of the blue, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I was shocked. I ate what I thought was a very healthy diet. I wasn't overweight. I had no known risk factors, nothing in my family. My subsequent research, I've discovered that the very high rate of breast cancer that we have in this society is out of all proportion to many parts of the world where they eat a much less affluent diet. There are places in Japan and many other parts of the world where hardly anybody knows anyone who's had breast cancer. I know far too many women who've had breast cancer and a number that have died, and I would just like to see that be vastly reduced. Anyway, I have always loved to eat. Some of my favorite memories of my childhood in England are of grazing in our garden, picking the ripe berries. My parents would wonder why there weren't many ripe berries. I never confessed. There were raspberries, strawberries, red and black currants, plump gooseberries, and loganberries. A while back, when friends suggested I see the documentary Food Inc., I procrastinated. Being a lifelong animal lover and animal eater, I knew that seeing this film would be upsetting. I was right. But seeing it did help me see the disconnect in my way of life. And I started to eat much less animal food. Then I started reading the China Study, the groundbreaking book on nutrition and human health. And I continued to gradually change my diet. And more recently, I saw the documentary Forks Over Knives, a very positive and inspiring film. It presents compelling scientific evidence supporting a shift to whole food, plant-based diet to benefit our own health, the health of our environment, and our ability to feed the world's burgeoning population. I know that making these changes myself will cause some of you to think I've gone a little nuts. But I feel great. And Don and I are discovering a world of delicious plant-based meals. And I'm feeling more peaceful and connected.
Our wisdom words this morning are from the book Hunger Enough: Living Spiritually in a Consumer Society. Building a compost pile is not unlike building a poem, making something out of nothing, turning straw into gold, garbage into loam, taking what others would throw out, eggshells, apple peels, coffee grounds, newspapers full of cumbersome verbiage, banana skins, grapefruit rinds, grass clippings, and adding to it daily. If it seems like nothing's happening, you're wrong. In the dark, heat and pressure build. Things begin to break down and add up. Turn, aerate, let it breathe. Add water, add worms, add eye of newt and bacteria. It's earthy as a river. It smells like a stable floor. Are those critics I hear typing away, or crickets in the corner of the woodpile? How do you know when it's done? Well, you don't. You just abandon it, to misquote Paul Verlaine. But when you scoop some out, it's moist and dark as chocolate tort. Black gold, this compost, this humus. It's a richness you can never get enough of. Spirit of life, spirit of love that moves between us and within us, hold us on this most beautiful day. Hold our joys. Hold those burdens that we carry with us. Be with us and help us to be present to one another. Amen.
The shining sun and fields where scarlet poppies run, and all the ripples of the wheat are in the bread that I do eat. So as I sit at every meal and sing a grace I always feel, that I am eating rain and sun and fields where scarlet poppies run. The silver rain, the shining sun and fields where scarlet poppies run, and all the ripples of the wheat are in the bread that I do eat. So as I sit at every meal and sing a grace I always feel, that I am eating rain and sun and fields where scarlet poppies run.
This is a reading from A Christmas Sermon on Peace by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Yes, as nations and individuals, we are interdependent. I have spoken to you before of our visit to India some years ago. It was a marvelous experience. But I say to you this morning that there were those depressing moments. How can one avoid being depressed when one sees with one's own eyes evidence of millions of people going to bed hungry at night? How can one avoid being depressed when one sees with one's own eyes thousands of people sleeping on the sidewalks at night? More than 1 million people sleep on the sidewalks of Bombay every night. More than 500,000 sleep on the sidewalks of Calcutta every night. They have no houses to go into. They have no beds to sleep in. As I beheld these conditions, something within me cried out, "Can we in America stand idly by and not be concerned?" And an answer came, "Oh, no." And I started thinking about the fact that right here in our country, we spend millions of dollars every day to store surplus food. And I said to myself, I know where we can store that food free of charge. in the wrinkled stomachs of the millions of God's children in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and even in our own nation who go to bed hungry at night. It really boils down to this, that all life is interrelated. We're all caught up in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied into a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. We are made to live together because of the interrelated structure of reality. Did you ever stop to think that you can't leave for your job in the morning without being dependent on most of the world? You get up in the morning and go in the bathroom and reach over for the sponge, and that's handed to you by a Pacific Islander. You reach for a bar of soap, and that's given to you at the hands of a Frenchman. And then you go into the kitchen to drink your coffee in the morning, and that's poured into your cup by a South American. And maybe you want tea. That's poured into your cup by Chinese. Or maybe you're desirous of having cocoa for breakfast, and that's poured into your cup by a West African. And then you reach over for your toast, and that's given to you at the hands of an English-speaking farmer, not to mention the baker. And before you finish eating breakfast in the morning, you've depended on more than half of the world. This is the way our universe is structured. This is the interrelated quality. We aren't going to have peace on Earth until we recognize this basic fact of the interrelated structure of all reality. Now, let me say secondly that if we are to have peace in the world, men and nations must embrace the nonviolent affirmation that ends and means must cohere. One of the great philosophical debates of history has been over the whole question of means and ends. And there have always been those who argued that the ends justified the means, that the means really aren't important. The important thing is to get to the end, you see. So if you're seeking to develop a just society, they say, the important thing is to get there, and the means are really unimportant. Any means will do as long as you get there. They may be violent. They may be untruthful means. They may be even unjust means to a just end. There have been those who have argued this throughout history, but we will never have peace in the world until men everywhere recognize that ends are not cut off from means, because the means represent the ideal in the making and the end in process, and ultimately you can't reach good ends through evil means, because the means represent the seed and the end represents the tree.
As much as I enjoy the summer, fall is my favorite time of year. Leaves change into their autumn wardrobe of golds, reds, and oranges. The familiar routine of the school year adds structure to the week. My favorite varieties of apples ripen, and our local orchard, Beckwith's, starts selling fresh cider. Years ago, autumn brought a sense of urgency, the need to set up stores of food for the upcoming winter. When I was a little girl, I loved the book, Little House in the Big Woods. Throughout the book, Laura Ingalls Wilder describes in detail the constant attention to preparing and preserving food so that it would keep during the off-season. The plump fall deer shot by paw were turned into strips of smoked venison. The family pig that ran wild in the woods was turned into ham and sausage. Milk was turned into butter and cheese. The oats were cut and threshed, and the grain stored, with some of the straw turned into wide-brimmed hats. Corn was turned into hominy. Nuts and honey were gathered from the woods. Hardy vegetables like onions, peppers, squash, and potatoes were put into cold storage. My own family practiced a modern, modified version of this kind of food preparation that was also based on the rhythm of the year. We had a large vegetable garden and raspberry patch. We would put all of our kitchen and yard waste into the compost pile, and in the late fall, use the rich humus to augment the soil. We would go out to farms in the far corners of the county and pick bushels of vegetables. Sometimes we would buy things at the farmer's market. We would pickle cucumbers, okra, and sauerkraut. We would can tomatoes and make jellies and jams. We dried slices of apples and stored them in cloth bags to be used later in pies. We would freeze the other vegetables and fruits. We bought walnuts, hazelnuts, and pecans in the shell. We also bought a whole pig from a local farm and shared it with my grandparents, preparing and freezing the different cuts and making garlicky Polish sausage out of the rest of it. I have to admit that most of this work was done by my parents and grandparents. It was done partly out of wanting to save money and partly out of habits formed during the Depression and while my grandparents were living as refugees during and after World War II. As a child at the time, it is easy for me to romanticize it. But even as an adult, I found that it is not that hard to can. It just takes a little bit of time and attention. This morning, I want to talk about food and mindfulness. There is one kind of mindfulness when we attend to the actual tasting and eating of food. But there is another kind of mindfulness, the mindfulness of how our relationship with food influences our relationship with creation, what we call the interdependent web of life. As the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King reminded us, we are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied into a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. We are made to live together because of the interrelated structure of reality. In our liberal religious practices, we often try to find ways to reconnect to nature. The 19th century American transcendentalists, who were also Unitarians, sought transcendence through the natural world. Ralph Waldo Emerson ends his seminal essay, Nature, with, "So shall we come to look at the world with new eyes? It shall answer the endless inquiry of the intellect. What is truth? And of the affections, what is good, by yielding itself passive to the educated will. Then shall come to pass what my poet said, nature is not fixed, but fluid. Spirit alters, molds, makes it. The immobility of or bruteness of nature is the absence of spirit. To pure spirit, it is fluid, it is volatile. It is obedient." He continues, "Build, therefore, your own world. As fast as you can form your life to the pure idea of your mind, then it will unfold its great proportions. A correspondent revolution in things will attend the influx of spirit." Henry David Thoreau conformed his own life to this ideal when he spent a couple of years in a cabin by Walden Pond, observing the changes of the seasons and the activities of the wildlife. He too ends his book with a countercultural message. If a man does not keep pace with his companions, perhaps it is because he hears a different drummer. Let him step to the music he hears, however measured or far away. The voices that call us to live counterculturally today, in a different relationship with nature than that of our consumer-focused society, are not led or dominated by the Unitarians or the Universalists. But because of our seventh principle, respect for the interdependence respect for the interdependent web of all existence, we are part of the conversation. In his essay, The Heart of a Faith for the 21st Century, the Reverend David Bumbaugh calls the seventh principle our radical theological position. He writes, "The seventh principle represents our peculiar contribution to the religious agenda. It calls us to reverence before the world, not some future world, but this miraculous world of our everyday experience. Part of our religious tradition is being present in the moment, in the here and the now." For the last few summers, my husband Randy and I have been riding our bikes on the local rail to trails. It is astonishing to watch the landscape change from week to week, with each wildflower blooming in its turn throughout the season. One week, the milkweed plants were full of monarch butterflies, giving the impression of shimmering black and orange petals. The rail to trail makes it seem that each stream or river crossed is an event. Since they're constructed on old railroad beds, the trails also give a different perspective of the town's factories by going through their backyards, where the vats of waste and the piles of excess inventory are in full view. The trails also seem to skirt the local water reclamation facilities. I once read a challenge by writer Wendell Berry to try to give directions without referring to any man-made landmarks, as if one were a pioneer when the land was first settled by white people. As a mindfulness exercise, I sometimes look at the scenery as I ride my bicycle, trying to look at the natural beauty with the same kind of attention that I pay to street signs, but it doesn't seem to make much of a difference. I think that this is because my life just doesn't depend on it. Literally, our ancestors' lives depended on their mindfulness of the natural world around them. They needed to know the lay of the land, or else they would get lost. And in the time of the hunters and gatherers, they needed to know where the food was, the patch of berry bushes, the apple trees, the nut trees. Later, with agricultural methods, food could be grown intentionally, with seeds saved from past crops. Even a couple of generations ago, most food that people ate was grown locally, either in their own gardens or by people they knew. But what has happened in the past couple of generations is that the growing of food has become globalized and specialized. Government subsidies have encouraged huge agricultural farms that grow soybeans and corn and have kept cheap the prices of foods that contain these ingredients. The cheap corn is also fed to livestock in concentrated animal feeding operations called CAFOs, keeping the price of meat artificially low. The ingredients that go into processed food, such as high fructose corn syrup, are cheap and plentiful. Most of the produce in our grocery stores is from the San Joaquin Valley, and more from other parts of the world. And from what I understand, today 10% of the fossil fuel that we consume is in support of our current system of food production. What we are doing is not sustainable. Now, I've read a lot of books and articles on this topic, and it's taking sheer will on my part not to go into the facts and details of the consequences of the way we currently eat in this country, and not to offer rational arguments for change. Instead, this morning I want to talk about how being mindful of our food choices has its own reward. Eating sustainably can result in sensuous pleasure. Fruits and vegetables that are eaten in season are at their peak in flavor and freshness. Compare an October apple to one purchased in June, or a tomato fresh off the vine in August to a styrofoam-like one purchased in the dead of winter. Food that travels across the country or across the ocean needs to have certain characteristics that allow it to pack and store well. In contrast, food that travels across town can be an heirloom variety that was bred for taste and texture. Fresh, grass-fed chicken eggs are perky with deep yellow yolks. Free-range chicken tastes like, well, chicken, but more so. Last year and the year before, our family subscribed to a CSA, a community-supported agriculture. At the beginning of the growing season, we paid a few $100s for a share of produce. Every week, we got a half dozen eggs and a box of fresh produce that was ripe that particular week. It was fun to be creative with the ingredients each week. If you've ever seen the Food Network show Iron Chef, our version we called Green Chef. A sample week's key ingredients might be potatoes, winter squash, lettuce, eggs, plum radishes, turnips, a tomato or two, and cabbages. Always cabbages. This year, due to my travel schedule, joining a CSA was not practical. But when I'm in town, I'm a regular at the Saturday Haymakers Farm Market here in Kent, which is a place where I see many of you and connect to others in our community and listen and talk to local folk musicians like the Celtic Clan yesterday. There are several booths with prepared food, cups of coffee, fresh baked bread, and at least one stand that features gluten-free products. We live only 8 blocks from the market, so we always walk down and further reduce our carbon footprint. On the way back, I often stop at our Kent Natural Foods Co-op downtown and pick up other staples such as herbs, yeast, and wheat germ. They also carry milk from Hartzler's, a local dairy that packages their milk in an old-fashioned glass bottle. Their milk does not contain bovine growth hormone and is neither homogenized nor ultra-pasteurized. I sometimes use it to make mozzarella or ricotta cheese. So I've talked a little bit about the kind of mindfulness around our relationship with food. I want to go back to the other kind of mindfulness, that of attending to the actual tasting and eating of food. I invite you, with your mind's eye, to think of your favorite fruit or vegetable. Now think about what that fruit or vegetable is like at its peak of ripeness. Imagine its color and texture. Imagine its fragrance. Imagine taking a bite and savoring the flavor, feeling the fullness of its perfection as taste, texture, and fragrance create a symphonic experience of the senses. In her essay, Eating Ethically, in the spring 2007 UU World magazine, Amy Hassinger wrote, "Imagine the possibilities of if each of our congregations committed to buying organic, shade-grown, fair trade coffee at our coffee hours and providing organic half and half for the cream. If we made a point of serving locally grown and or organic food at each social event or fundraising dinner. If we made each of our churches available as a drop-off point for a local CSA or farm cooperative. Imagine what might happen if our congregations took the lead in our communities by facilitating relationships between other churches or even other institutions, such as retirement homes and hospitals, and local farmers. I see some of these possibilities becoming realities. Last week, at our General Assembly in Charlotte, North Carolina, after 3 years of study and debate in our member congregations, including this one, we Unitarian Universalists passed a statement of conscience on ethical eating, which will guide our congregations as they seek out and advocate for food that is raised responsibly. But as we advocate for ethical eating, let us not forget our imaginations. Let us find creative ways to live sustainable lives. Let us find meaningful ways to encourage our neighbors to do the same. And let us do so with joy and appreciation of the delights that such ways will bring. Amen, and blessed be. Let us give thanks for gifts of this earth. Let us relearn how to live in harmony with all that share in this, our interconnected web of life. And let us share that message with the rest of our human family. Amen.